Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for the Jerry Impala Show with your hosts, Jerry Williams and Paula Alexander. Your first host from Cincinnati, Ohio, and a former police officer, let's give a round of applause for the one and only Jerry Williams.
Welcome to the show. This is your host, Jerry Williams, and we are going to get into some breaking news that's been happening. And first and foremost, let me just say that Paula is off tonight. We will be back tomorrow, which is Sunday, at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Make sure you join us tomorrow at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. All right, so in the breaking news, here is what we found that's been happening. And I'm sure if people have been following through with Texas, then you know that Texas has had a serious issue in the last past week where they had a winter storm that went through Texas. Of course, Texas never really sees this kind of winter, like, you know, winter snow, especially this much of the snow and ice. But the truth of the matter is it got really shady because the government in Texas, the state government, did not do really much of anything, including even Ted Cruz went on vacation, leaving his state to fend for themselves. Wow. So Texas officials are investigating the outrageous energy bills, by the way. Now, this is something else that's been happening. So Texas has been having a lot of issues with this from their energy department. Now, here's what they're saying. So Dallas resident DeAndre Upshaw, said it was very shocking when she opened his bill just recently, his latest electricity bill. While I'm trying to get gas and groceries and make sure that my pipes don't explode, the last thing I'm thinking about is a $7,000 bill from my utility company. Upshaw told CNN's Frederica Whitfield via Skype Saturday that they did not really feel that this, you know, $7,000 bill. as Texas struggles to recover from a deep freeze that has killed dozens. Some customers in Texas, like Upshaw, are facing unprecedented price hikes in their energy bills as a result of the recent snowstorm. A Texas official say they are investigating it. The Texas Utility Regulator Public Utility Commission of Texas said Saturday that it is investigating the factors that combined with the devastating winter weather to disrupt and flow of power to millions of Texas homes. It is also giving customers a way to use an emergency power provider in the event their current provider is not available. But it's likely that this program doesn't apply to people who voluntarily change their electricity company. So Texas Governor Greg Abbott is conveying with an emergency meeting to look into the situation, he said, in a statement. It's unacceptable for Texans who suffered through days in freezing cold without electricity or heat to now be hit with a skyrocketing energy costs, Abbott said, to protect families. I'm actively working with Lieutenant Governor, the Speaker of the House, and members of my legislature to develop solutions to ensure that Texans are not hooked for unreasonable spikes in their energy bills. One energy company called the Gritty suggested that their customers look for another provider if the prices were too high. So a lot of things are happening with Texas, and there's a lot of people who are facing very high bills, not only $7,000, but they're seeing it up to over $15,000 in electric bills. So a lot of people are getting very upset with this in Texas, and I don't blame them, because why should they have to use, or why should they be having to pay for this? I just think it's very important that we really pay attention to that kind of stuff, you know. And since Joe Biden has taken office, by the way, we have noticed, and this is what they were saying, that COVID-19 hospitalizations in the U.S. dipped to the lowest level since November. So they are actually seeing a decrease in COVID cases, but they're also seeing a decrease in people wanting to get tested. And that was a major situation. They were having so many people trying to get tested for COVID-19, and now they're seeing a decrease in COVID testing, which is really cool, you know. So it's truly amazing the difference that this really makes for what's going on here. And, you know, that's the thing about it. Joe Biden is now putting out a stimulus package, and he is looking forward for the stimulus package to be going through very soon. And the Republican Party, of course, is trying to put up a wall, fight this, because they don't want people getting the money. They don't want people to have money. But we need to fight back against the Republicans and tell them no, right? We need to say no, no is enough. And I would really hope that our Democrats and Joe Biden, the President of the United States, would just say the hell with it. We're going to go vote for it, you know, because we need the stimulus package for people who are suffering right now more than ever. There are people suffering right now more than ever with a COVID vaccine or with this COVID crisis. So it's very important that we really get ahead of this and move on. I really truly believe that. I think that people don't realize that, you know, we're dealing with a serious situation. And there are people being evicted from their homes. Joe Biden did sign into effect a bill, that stated that, you know, that they could not be evicted. People could not be evicted from their homes. However, people are still being evicted because that's what they do. These landlords don't give a shit. They're very ruthless people. And even though you're having issues trying to survive, you know, they don't really care about that. So it's kind of of a crazy situation here, but we need to really start moving forward instead of going backwards. And really, the only way to do that is to keep Donald Trump in the back rear view window, looking back and saying, goodbye, Mr. Trump. And we need to move forward in making, the whole situation to where we can grow and be stronger as a country. You know, we need to be unified. And that's what's really important here, that we stay unified together as one. I mean, that's what's important. So anyway, we have all these different scenarios happening. And this is why we need to keep looking at what we need to do to keep the coronavirus at bay and watching it, people getting healed from it. And, of course, now there's vaccines where people can get the vaccines, right? You can get vaccinated. And when you get vaccinated, this will help to eliminate the spread of COVID in a certain way. So that's what's important here for us to know. But we just need to keep looking for the future. We need to keep looking forward because it's very important for this. And also, in other news, a plane safely returns to the airport after dropping debris over Colorado. A Boeing 777 was going from Denver to Honolulu when it experienced failure with its right engine shortly after takeoff and returned safely to Denver International Airport. The FAA said that United Flight 328 was flying over Broomfield, Colorado, when it dropped debris in several locations, police said. No injuries have been reported, but the truly matter, if you go look at the pictures of this stuff, oh my God, the debris that they dropped was just unbelievable. I thought that one of it looked like it was a piece of the outer ring of the engine. You know, it was really kind of creepy looking. But if you haven't had a chance, take a look at that because it's really creepy. Team that they have the pieces of this debris that could have really done some damage to people, okay? With that said, we're going to move on to the next part, and that's what is in the news. And I just want to go into the next part of this. And yesterday we kind of covered about gas prices or what was happening, right? Because gas prices are on a rise. And a lot of people keep saying, well, it's Joe Biden's fault. Joe Biden, he's the one who did this. But is it truly the president of the United States who is to be blamed for high gas prices? Well, a lot of people would say yes, because that's what the Trump people believe. But the truth of the matter is, it doesn't work like that. As a matter of fact, corporations and companies own the oil companies to be able to, you know, be able to sell this oil to different companies, like, you know, your gas stations, and then they put a price on it and they raise it up. So does that affect because of Joe what the president of the United States does? No, it does not. As a matter of fact, the president of the United States has no affiliation with these gas manufacturers whatsoever. And what I mean by that is that they don't have control to tell them whether to raise their prices or lower them. The only thing that there's a part of with the government is there's a regulatory where they have to make sure that they don't try to overcharge people. Where, in other words, if they try to do gas wars, make gas hikes to where people have to afford, like, you know, $20 a gallon, for example, would be very much different. And that's where there are some stipulations in there. But the president of the United States has no formal blame if the gas prices go up and down. You know what I'm saying? So let's look at this. We talked about it yesterday, and this is some new audio I'm going to play for you. This is, first, let's look at the company called OPEC. A lot of people probably don't know what OPEC is, but let's look at what OPEC is when it comes to gas prices. And this will kind of help educate you what gas prices are, how gas goes up and down. It also educates you on the history of gas pricing in Saudi Arabia, where a lot of our gas comes from overseas. Now, a lot of people believe that if we just pumped oil and gas here in the United States, it'd be a little different. But what we need to look at is what I'm about ready to show you or let play for you. So let's listen to this audio clip. There's a few of them here. And this is about OPEC and the history of OPEC.
Thanks to technological innovation helping us find more oil, refine it better, and then use it more efficiently, the price of it nowadays is mostly influenced by politics.
If you live in a country that mostly uses oil from within its own borders, then the price of it is going to be largely impacted by your own country's environmental regulation and tax policies. If you live in a country, however, that imports most of its oil, it's going to be impacted by your country's foreign policy or the foreign policy of other countries.
Now, foreign policy mostly impacts the price of oil when it politically destabilizes a part of the world that exports a lot of oil. Luckily for us, the parts of the world that export a lot of oil tend to be super politically stable. However, prior to politics or technological innovation impacting the price of oil, there was an international organization set up in the wake of World War II to help regulate and, well, manipulate the price of it, called OPEC. So, what exactly is OPEC and why does it exist?
The two world wars turned oil into the fuel of modernity. All the great powers needed it to fuel not only the guns of war, but the butter of peace. Western oil companies, often aided by their home governments, went around the world and brokered deals with newly independent countries in need of money. In exchange for control of their oil, these new governments got a quick and easy supply of cash. These deals were great for Western oil companies, but not as good for the governments they were dealing with, and even worse for the citizens of those countries. Back in the 1940s and 50s, the oil companies wanted to restrict the production of oil in order to maintain a higher price. But this conflicted with the interests of local governments, who couldn't make money if oil wasn't flowing. And considering how bad the profit-splitting deal was for them, that's really saying something. However, these oil-exporting countries eventually tried striking back, starting with Venezuela, who refused to accept any deals with less than a 50-50 split in the profits. They tried to get other oil countries to make the same deals in order to avoid a competitive disadvantage, but this was too little too late. As more former colonies gained independence, more oil became available. And when you really need the money like they did, you don't care about undermining your competitors. This resulted in the supply of oil increasing, and therefore a decrease in the price. The increased supply of oil hurt smaller oil companies operating on smaller profit margins. In the US, President Eisenhower responded with an executive order, placing controls on the import of foreign oil. The oil companies responded by increasing oil production to the point where it was so cheap that buying domestically was financially unfeasible. Many small oil companies went out of business, and the drop in price hurt the oil-producing countries as well as the companies. This is why OPEC became a thing. In September of 1960, the oil ministers of Venezuela and Saudi Arabia organized a conference of oil countries in Baghdad, which included representatives from Iraq, Iran, and Kuwait. At this meeting, they created the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC. The goals of the organization were stated in the first two resolutions.
The principal aim of the organization shall be the unification of petroleum policies for the member countries and the determination of the best means for safeguarding the interests of member countries individually and collectively. Members shall demand that oil companies maintain their prices steady and free from all unnecessary fluctuation.
Now, just because you establish an organization to make money doesn't necessarily mean it will, and for OPEC, that was definitely the case.
One of the problems OPEC had in its early years was a complete lack of experience in everything having to do with the oil industry. Everything from pulling it out of the ground to selling it and advertising it was done by foreigners. The member states of OPEC were so unprepared that a representative for Standard Oil said,
"We attached little importance to it because we believed it would not work."
And at the time, this was the case. The people OPEC countries started putting in charge not only lacked the technical knowledge, but were also not well versed in how the market for oil impacted prices. They demanded a fixed price for the oil so that no matter what it sold for on the open market, they got a guaranteed amount. This resulted in bad economic signaling, and that from their perspective, all they needed to do was increase oil production and they got paid. In some instances, this resulted in the oil companies paying more for the oil they bought than they made selling it, and in others, they made a lot more. At this time, however, it was mostly the former.
The downward trend in world oil prices during the 1960s is widely believed to have been the result of competition among the international oil companies. In a limited sense, this was true. More fundamentally, however, prices declined because members of OPEC had much to gain by increasing their levels of output, and the international majors were unable to prevent expansion.
The OPEC countries eventually learned that they needed to restrict the supply of oil in the market in order to increase revenues, and they began to do so as more countries gained independence and began to sell oil. Some of these new countries would be given membership in the organization, such as Qatar, who joined in 1961, followed by Libya and Indonesia in 1962, the United Arab Emirates in 1967, Algeria in 1969, Nigeria in 1971, and Ecuador in 1973. OPEC, however, suffered from internal instability, such as when Kuwait gained independence in 1961 and Iraq threatened to invade based on claims that the British separated Kuwait from the rest of Iraq. The crisis was averted when a coalition of Arab countries threatened to attack Iraq if they attacked Kuwait. Iran was another sore spot in OPEC, as it rarely followed OPEC decisions and refused to limit its production or sale of oil, which undercut the other members and allowed them to gain a greater market share. In fact, most members of OPEC didn't follow the orders to limit oil production, and for the most part, it has never successfully implemented any long-term price controls. Rather, the only thing that has ever successfully unified OPEC members and gained them power were political crises. 1967 saw the outbreak of both the Nigerian Civil War and another Arab-Israeli war. The Nigerian Civil War broke out when the region called Biafra wanted to secede from the country and take control of the oil. The fighting disrupted the supply of oil being exported from the country, which put upward pressure on prices. The Arab-Israeli War of 1967 saw the first attempt at an oil embargo. Egypt closed off the Suez Canal, which forced oil tankers to go around the Horn of Africa. And the countries of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, Libya, and Algeria banned oil shipments to the US and the UK, and the overall flow of oil from Arab nations reduced by 60%. However, the US was little impacted by the embargo due to the excess oil reserves they had built up at the time. The next major change occurred in 1969 with the Libyan Revolution, which put Muammar Gaddafi into power.
You know what also changed at this point? This video being brought to you by mid-rolls, maybe. And if a mid-roll didn't just play for you, then I would like to thank my patrons for helping make this video possible. Thanks to their support, I can put more focus on making interesting videos rather than chasing the algorithm. To find out more, you can go to patreon.com/casualhistorian. But now, back to the video.
Under Gaddafi's rule, Libya forced renegotiations with oil companies in order to give them a better profit ratio. They also began to train their own oil experts so they didn't have to rely on foreign contractors. They also forced foreign companies to negotiate with the Libyan government individually rather than collectively, which gave the Libyan government the upper hand. They also cut back oil production by ending their work with smaller oil companies, and nationalized a number of them. What happened in Libya put a scare into the Western oil companies, and thus gave the OPEC government a tool to use during negotiations. The Arab-Israeli conflict would continue to be a unifying issue for many OPEC members, and as tensions began to increase before the Yom Kippur War, the Saudi government warned U.S. oil companies that access to oil would be cut off if the U.S. supported Israel in any armed conflict with an Arab state.
Good evening. The Middle East war produced developments all over the world today. The oil-producing countries of the Arab world decided to use their oil as a political weapon.
In a panicked frenzy, the U.S. oil companies began to lobby the U.S. government not to support Israel, but the Nixon administration refused to give in to the threats. In response, OPEC nations began to cut down their production levels by 5% every month until their demands were met. This drove up the price for oil in countries like the U.S. and the U.K., where scenes of cars lined up around the block at gas stations are a permanently fixed image of the decade.
Western countries responded to the embargo by searching for oil in other places such as Alaska, the North Sea, or Sub-Saharan Africa, as well as encouraging investment into technologies that allow you to get more oil, refine it more efficiently, and to use the oil and gasoline from it more efficiently in vehicles. However, most of these investments wouldn't pay off until later.
The Nixon administration actually had plans to invade numerous Gulf states and occupy the oil fields.
A peacekeeping force will go to the Mideast. And this force, however, will not include any forces from the major powers, including, of course, the United States and the Soviet Union. The question, however, has arisen as to whether observers from major powers could go to the Mideast. My up-to-the-minute report on that, and I just talked to Dr. Kissinger 5 minutes before coming down, is this. We will send observers to the Mideast if requested by the Secretary General of the United Nations, and we have reason to expect that we will receive such a request. With regard to the peacekeeping force, I think it's important for all of you ladies and gentlemen.
But they eventually dropped those plans for rationing instead. Oil shipments wouldn't return to normal for the U.S. until the spring of 1974.
Last January 15th, I went before your senators and representatives in Congress with a comprehensive plan to make our country independent of foreign sources of energy by 1985.
The U.S. implemented new policies to limit the damage of any future crisis with the Energy Policy and Conservation Act of 1975 and the creation of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, or SPR. The SPR was designed to hold enough oil to sustain the U.S. economy for 3 months by 1975 standards. It would be expanded in 2007 in order to meet the new usage levels and the higher oil prices of the time.
The embargo greatly enriched the OPEC countries. And do you know what they did with these windfall profits? Did they invest in internal infrastructure or in a way to diversify their economy so it wasn't dependent upon the export of a single commodity? Nope. Instead, the oil monarchs spent it on big mansions, Western luxury goods, and weapons. Lots and lots of weapons. In fact, what's kind of funny about the oil embargo is that Western fears of it have lasted a lot longer than the riches gained from it by the OPEC nations.
The U.S. tried to undermine the unity of OPEC countries by courting the Shah of Iran, who was never as invested in the Palestinian cause as the Gulf state monarchs. Iran purchased tons of U.S.-made weapons, and unlike the Arab monarchs, actually tried to modernize their economy. The problem with that, however, was it disrupted the largely agricultural work that the majority of Iranians still did. This drove Iranian peasants into the cities, which didn't have enough houses or jobs for them. When the revolution broke out in 1978, there were plenty of poor, angry people who were ready to toss out the Shah and turn against everything he was seen to support, including the U.S. During the revolution, oil exports from Iran dried up, and so the other OPEC members initially increased their production in order to make up the difference. But OPEC eventually voted to allow members to sell their oil for as much as they could get foreigners to pay, so long as they didn't go below the OPEC price floor. Saudi Arabia protested this move, fearing it would spur on more oil exploration and technological investment in the West, but it was to no avail. The 1980s saw a big drop in the price of oil as new sources in Alaska, the North Sea, and Mexico became active. On top of that, we saw new technological advances use fossil fuels more efficiently, and the use of other energy sources such as increased nuclear energy in Europe and the return of coal in the United States. These developments were so significant that by 1982, a majority of the crude oil used in the West came from non-OPEC countries. In response to this, OPEC countries began to reduce production as a means of trying to increase the price. They still had restrictions on how much each country could produce, but Saudi Arabia was given a special role as the swing producer. Basically, whatever shortfall occurred in the market, Saudi Arabia was forced to make up the difference by producing more oil. This turned out bad for the Saudis when oil was cheap. Throughout the 80s, OPEC tried to fight the oil glut by adopting and abandoning price controls until 1988 when they finally dropped price controls permanently. Since then, the price of oil has been determined by supply and demand rather than by the arbitrary controls of a cartel. The biggest influence on the supply and demand of oil have been political and technological developments. Conflicts in the Middle East tend to raise the price of oil. However, on occasion, Saudi Arabia would choose to increase production as a means of foreign policy, ingratiating itself with the U.S., especially when it wants to buy weapons. For example, after 9/11, Saudi Arabia increased oil production in order to maintain market prices. However, they wouldn't do the same after the 2003 invasion of Iraq, allowing the prices to rise to the highs we saw in the 2000s. In recent years, the low prices of oil have been fueled by technological developments, allowing older oil wells to extract more oil, or allowing the extraction of oil from places we couldn't before. The membership of OPEC has expanded and contracted over the years. In 1975, Gabon joined, but then left again in 1995, only to rejoin in 2016. Ecuador, which had joined in 1973 around the time of the oil crisis, left in 1992, rejoined in 2007, and then left again on January 1, 2020. Angola joined in 2007, while Indonesia left in 2008. Equatorial Guinea joined in 2017, followed by the Republic of the Congo in 2018. And Qatar left OPEC in 2019, after over a year of diplomatic pressure and shifting its production to natural gas instead of oil.
As our reliance upon oil declines, so does the power of OPEC nations. And there are some knock-on effects for this, such as less money going into the pockets of dictators and terrorists, which is nice. However, it also happens that a lot of these countries that rely on exporting oil, that is their one developed industry. And if you take away the one developed part of their economy, what are these poor, politically unstable countries going to do? So you take the good with the bad, and until that point, I'm going to be stuck paying California prices for dinosaur juice stuck in the ground. If you enjoyed this video, then I would recommend subscribing and clicking the bell icon to be notified of when more videos come out. I might also recommend that you click the like button, because see, clicking the like button tells the algorithm to suggest more of this channel's videos to you. So that way, when I do put up a video, there is more likely to be seen by you.
It seemed like a great idea. The world's largest oil producing company pumping millions of barrels a day to become the world's largest ever traded stock.
أرامكو ما في شك أنها جزء من المفاتيح الرئيسية لهذه الرؤية ولنهضة الاقتصاد ونهضة المملكة العربية السعودية.
An overambitious prince eager to make his mark as a reformer wanted to partially trade Saudi Aramco for a valuation of $2 trillion. But the venture failed to get off the ground, and the prince's Vision 2030 now seems blurry.
Saudi Aramco is almost like the basis of politics in Saudi Arabia.
They are always intrinsically tied.
Everybody in Saudi Arabia, in one way or another, is a beneficiary of Saudi Aramco.
A strong Saudi Arabia needs a strong Aramco, and vice versa as well.
The history of Saudi Aramco is the history of Saudi Arabia transforming itself from an isolated tribal society into a global presence.
Get it right, you reap a windfall. Get it wrong, and the risk is huge. The whole Saudi economy was at stake.
There's always a balance between how that you face the risk and to adopt with a new paradigm in the world.
They run the risk of being toppled. The royal family could be running for the hills.
The issue is really, you know, is an IPO best for the company? And when you look at Aramco, the company, you have to realize that unlike other companies, Aramco operated for years without ever imagining an IPO. So they've never had to make decisions with the thought of, oh, we're someday maybe going to be publicly listed, or we'd like to publicly list. Here's how we need to have our finances arrayed. Here's the kind of growth that we need to be showing in our financial statements to make investors see our value. Analysts have never followed Aramco because it was never seen as a potential investment. And now that's changing. Aramco for many years has had a strategy of long-term growth and long-term revenue because their idea was that they were making money for the benefit of the Saudi state. If they're gonna IPO, then they've gotta suddenly think about their quarterly reports. And that may change how they invest. And that may not be the best strategy for Saudi Arabia.
The kingdom holds about 16% of the world's oil reserves. It's the largest exporter of petroleum among OPEC countries. And that means its economy relies heavily on oil. 90% of exports, 87% of budget revenues, nearly half of GDP all comes from oil. Towering over these numbers is the company which digs out, refines, and exports that oil. It pumps one out of every 8 barrels of oil in the world, and it's the only company which can produce a barrel of oil for less than $10. Aramco says it employs 65,000 people, but creates direct and indirect work for hundreds of thousands in the kingdom. So if it's doing so well, why let it go?
I think there was a strong case for the IPO, and there still is for the selling off a stake of Saudi Aramco, and there are lots of reasons for it. Now, it's been talking about diversifying its economy for years. I think the specter of climate action has finally made the Saudis get serious about it. And really, the only way to diversify is through Aramco. I mean, Aramco is the source of revenues that the Saudi state needs to build other economic sectors.
Even the reserve is big in other countries, you know, in Middle East, but still, there's depletable resources. Someday, somehow, the oil will be depleted, will be exhausted. So they have to think that, you know, you have to diversify your energy, the economy.
So it's kind of ironic you're going to be relying on oil to diversify away from fossil fuels. So if you think about Saudi risk, it's 100% owner of this company that supplies almost 100% of its government budget. Okay, if it sees a risk to that company, even a far off risk, it needs to start diversifying that risk, and passing some of that along to foreign investors is one way of doing it.
Concerns about radical changes in strategy put a spanner in the works for Saudi Aramco's public listing. For the first time in its history, the company would have to disclose everything.
I think when you consider the size and scope and the opportunity, there's a lot of emotion and also a lot of momentum. And sometimes when momentum and emotion get rolling, you may lose sight of the reality of what you had to do when it came to effectively being now an open public company.
Vision 2030 was unveiled as a master plan for socioeconomic reforms. As a result, women can drive. Cinemas have begun to pop up. Mohammed bin Salman's aim was to reorient the Saudi economy away from oil and reassure investors that Saudi Arabia is stable and progressive. A lot has changed since the prince's international public relations drive. The efforts to convince businessmen to feel comfortable working in the kingdom also faced a blow when top Saudi business kingpins were put under arrest in an opaque anti-corruption drive. And as a cascading effect, there has been flight of capital, reduced foreign investment, increased Saudi borrowing, and a halt on Saudi Aramco's IPO.
The increase in internal repression inside the kingdom, you know, locking up of folks inside the Ritz-Carlton. A lot of those were heads of family businesses or large companies or big conglomerates. That gives foreign investors pause.
The murder of one journalist has washed away the veneer of change and quashed investor confidence.
I'm not asking for democracy. I'm asking for people to be allowed to speak. I'm asking for the minimum.
Can the interest of a stakeholder ever get priority over the kingdom? The privatization process would mean Saudi oil reserves will be up for scrutiny, and Aramco's finances will be in the public eye.
You go from running a business where you have endless resources and no oversight to one day having to register your company with the exchange and having to disclose every single number the company's had over the last 5 to 10 years. Every piece of CapEx, every decision that's been made, every partnership, every single thing you've done is now in the public purview.
Once that we move to the public control, the state companies, I think that's begin by the transparency, because the company is not only belong to the state, to the government, but belongs also to the public.
If you're a private company that's run so well, it's painful because you have to answer a lot of questions. But not nearly as painful as after you take people's money.
Those Saudi economists who dared to raise concerns about the prince's ambitious 2030 plans are in jail. A day before the Khashoggi murder, prominent economist Issam Al-Zamal was indicted on terrorism-related charges. His crime was providing analysis, some of which explained that a high valuation of Aramco could mean that the kingdom will not get any oil revenue for decades, because all of it will go to an Aramco controlled by shareholders.
In the beginning stages, you haven't taken anyone's money, presumably. You're just disclosing to the exchanges, here's how we run our business, here's why you should be comfortable listing us. You then go out to raise capital. And once you're taking someone else's money, they own those shares. And you're a company for the people, by the people. You're not a company for the management or the kingdom. And the transition's massive.
That changeover from state control to a public listing, which began in 2017, is now shelved for years to come. Key Aramco executives have also left or been moved.
So that process for a company like this, probably a year and a half. It's not like a tech startup where you have a a slide presentation and some hope. You have a business that changes global markets for decades and decades. So it's a process that will be expansive, it will be intrusive, and it will be transformative.
Saudi Aramco places the kingdom's reserves at 261 billion barrels of oil. But that magic number, with no real third-party audit, has remained more or less constant for nearly 30 years. Since the 1980s, there have been rising production, changes in technology, and no announcements of major oil discoveries in the kingdom. Other oil giants such as Shell and Exxon have revised down their reserves during this period. If, on average, Saudi production was at 9 million barrels a day, in the last 30 years, Aramco has pumped out nearly 100 billion barrels without a dent in its 261 billion reserves. And the jury's out on how much they actually have and what it's worth.
Looking at their reserves figure is, you know, makes, if you look too closely at it, you start to wonder how it can stay roughly constant from year to year when they're producing and exporting so much oil every year.
Disclosure of the reserves is a top secret in Saudi Arabia. And I think this is a significant concern on the part of Aramco executives. They treat their reserves with kid gloves. Their duty is to get the most out of these reserves in the best way possible.
The reserve confidence will only be consistent with third parties verifying the information. It's got to be done through a regulatory fashion that everyone's comfortable with. It can't just be something a company says and hopes is the case. You've got to verify.
Whatever other qualities God may have given the Saudis, he gave them a lot of wealth in the ground. And that's not going to go away. So one might quibble over the reserves. But the Saudis have the ability to do fracking. And they haven't even started, basically.
But would that possibility of higher reserves be enough for investors to finance Aramco's IPO?
Probably the biggest downside is the transparency that would have resulted around Saudi reserves, Saudi oil reserves. That doesn't change very much from year to year and really hasn't changed much over the past couple of decades. It doesn't give much insight beyond this single number. You know, around 260 billion barrels. If Saudi Aramco would have listed shares in the New York Stock Exchange or the London Stock Exchange, the regulators would have forced Saudi Arabia to come clean on all of its reserves, how much of that is proven, probable, or otherwise. I think that's a tough sell within the kingdom, within Saudi Aramco and within the ministry and all the way up to the head of state.
I don't think Saudi Arabia is not trustworthy when it comes to their reserves. I think the reserves are there, but the capacity is another question.
Saudi Aramco has never produced 12.5 million barrels a day and has never come within about a million barrels a day of that. Aramco says that it can reach that level of capacity after a period of about 6 months of additional investment. Right, so it can't just twist a few valves and crank up an extra 2 million barrels a day.
I can remember on one occasion sitting in the office of the then Minister of Petroleum, who did not know that I understood Arabic, when one of his aides came rushing in and said, we've proved the reserves in this particular new field they'd found. And he said, well, how much is it? And they said, 3 billion barrels. And he said, oh, it's too small. Cap it. Well, that's twice the Alaska reserve.
If you had full access to Aramco's reserves figures and, other inside details about its revenue streams and whatnot, you know, anybody with a smartphone could second guess the Saudi minister. You know, right now when the oil minister goes to Vienna to speak in public at an OPEC meeting, you can see him just surrounded by hordes of reporters, each shoving their voice recorder in his face to catch a little snippet of what he says about Saudi plans, Saudi reserves, Saudi oil production, Saudi market strategy. The world wouldn't be quite as dependent on the oil minister for information, you know, to sort of unlock the you know, the secrets of what Aramco was going to do.
Also, you know, you put those that information out there, it's out there for everyone.
We should just be dynamic and responsive.
The reserves matter because the reserves and output give Saudi Arabia the regional and international clout as the largest producer in the oil-producing club of nations known as OPEC.
Vacation, travel, lodging, billions and billions and billions of dollars of industry get moved by OPEC. And OPEC being a Saudi-driven organization, they have to be meticulous.
The company is so good at what it does that also brings its leaders a certain amount of political clout when it comes to OPEC and when it comes to other dealings with other countries.
OPEC is not a cartel. You know, we really want to stabilize the oil price to some extent. You know, the unity of OPEC, I think, is still important to how then we can bring together the stabilizer of the price. But it's not the price that benefit only the producer. It's the price that also benefit the producer and consumer.
The history of OPEC, we're an economic organization focused on fundamentals, focused on addressing the global market's needs for reliable supplies of petroleum.
Saudi Arabia is the keystone in OPEC. It is the big dog. It's the ringleader, if you will, within OPEC. OPEC members maintain a little bit here and there. None has more than 1 million barrels per day of spare oil production capacity that I know of. It maintains that kind of level of spare capacity as a policy. Saudi Arabia, Saudi Aramco, typically maintain, you know, a million, 2 million barrels, 2 million barrels a day of oil production capacity that they don't use. Okay, so no profit-oriented firm would ever do this, right? You wouldn't invest all the billions in developing oil fields and pipelines and storage facilities and production infrastructure and then just leave it dormant. Saudi Aramco has done it at the behest of the Saudi state, and you know, it's the key aspect in the Saudi-U.S. partnership, Aramco's ability to bring more oil production online, and its willingness to cut back at times when markets are oversupplied. It's kind of the crux of the U.S.-Saudi strategic partnership.
Saudi Arabia, if we broke with them, I think your oil prices would go through the roof. I've kept them down. They've helped me keep them down. Right now we have low oil prices, or relatively. I'd like to see it go down even lower.
Billions of dollars are traded at the world's largest stock exchange. It's business as usual on Wall Street, but like other exchanges around the world, it also tried to sway Saudi Aramco to list in New York. Even the U.S. president weighed in on his preferred medium of communication. But the strict requirements remained a deterrent for the IPO, which was being called the world's largest offering. It would be a double whammy for Mohammed bin Salman to not get the $2 trillion valuation and having to compromise on not listing on the world's largest stock market.
You're the world's largest oil producer and you don't list in the world's largest stock exchange. That definitely says something. And it definitely limits your access to capital.
New York is terribly complicated by virtue of the 9/11 hangover. So I thought from the beginning it was quite, you know, it was a nice thing to dangle before the Americans, but it was probably not going to come to us.
You know, there aren't that many exchanges that can do this. So London and New York were the two main ones that that could really handle something like this, both of which have pretty stringent transparency requirements. New York's more so. London was signaling that it was willing to roll back some of its transparency requirements and make a special deal for Aramco.
The Prince's IPO hit the brakes, from a lofty $2 trillion valuation to uncertainty about the size of Saudi reserves, from litigation risks to stringent requirements from stock exchanges. The reality was different from the political statements.
Well, I think the $2 trillion number was significant for Saudis, but not significant for the rest of the market. We're talking about a business that dwarfs almost every business in the S&P 500.
I would say $2 trillion is a high valuation. It's not unachievable.
When you look at what the size of it is, whether it's a trillion and a half, or $2 trillion, the scale is all relative. It's massive. And so if you have a business that's earning $200, $300, $400 billion a year, there's a multiple put on that. And the market's going to say, well, even though you're a $1 trillion business, give or take, whether you're $1 trillion or $3 trillion is going to be dependent on your earnings and your decline curves and your growth strategy. What type of growth percentage can I put on your business?
It's a huge number. There's no question about it. Whether you look at the high level or you look at the low level, it's huge. It's a huge IPO. It's a huge company. And so I guess what you're asking me is, how do they expect to sell it? I think there's enough of money out there that can cover it. But if, on the other hand, the global economy should begin to tick downward, then it's going to be a hard sell. They would have to lower the price.
Putting a line in the sand is strong and smart from your own perspective, but the market's going to determine what they feel comfortably about buying your stock at. That's worth what someone tells you it's worth, not what you hope it's worth.
So when Mohammed bin Salman announced the Aramco IPO, and he basically said, we're looking for a valuation of $2 trillion. And that's the largest valuation of all time for any company. And that's a valuation for the whole company. They were never talking about selling any more than 5%. So it seems like they're looking to raise $100 billion, which is a large amount, but not that much. So, but the question is really, is Aramco valued at $2 trillion? What are their oil reserves valued at, which is really tends to be the bulk of what makes up an oil company valuation. Now, Aramco also has a lot of other assets around the world, not oil, not upstream oil assets, but they own shares in refineries in China, in South Korea. They own oil storage facilities in Japan. They own the largest oil refinery in the United States. And they also have a lot of research and development things going on. They've also got petrochemical and oil refineries in Saudi Arabia. So the company is worth more than what they dig out of the ground and sell. But does that get us to $2 trillion? The answer also depends on what the price of oil is at the time of the IPO. And when they announced the IPO, we were in the midst of a period of very low oil prices. So you could see how it would be very hard to reach a $2 trillion valuation in, say, 2017, when the price of oil was, you know, $50 or $55 a barrel.
It's an indirect evaluation of the Saudi economy, which is reliant on Aramco. So it's not just a company with a proposed $2 trillion price tag.
There's a major problem with valuing the company. What is it that's being offered? Some slice of the overall company, I guess, but no direct ownership of any part of it. How much are the reserves after all? Are they understated or overstated? What level of efficiency does Saudi Aramco have in comparison with other oil companies? Where is the future market?
Mohammed bin Salman's vision was to take the money from the IPO to revamp the Saudi Public Investment Fund, which would play a leading role in developing non-oil industries. But that fund has already started borrowing money instead of stacking up oil revenues. The tens of billions expected from Aramco never arrived, and global banks provided their first ever loan of $11 billion.
The IPO, it seems to be, from what people say, was designed to generate cash for the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, which is designed to make investments for the future, not to use for the Saudi budget, not to use for those kind of projects, but really a sovereign wealth fund to rely on, you know, when oil is no longer an important commodity.
Here you have a company which has been deliberately non-transparent, not listed on any market. It has no shareholders other than the kingdom itself to which to report. Saudi Arabia is not a notably free press environment, and it is not a democracy, and accountability is uncertain.
The kingdom is home to the most important religious sites for Muslims, but Saudi Arabia's real source of power is its oil wealth, and Aramco converts that black gold into dollars and riyals. Many academics, experts, and oil economists either refused or refrained from speaking to us. As soon as they heard us about Aramco, the kingdom's most potent economic firepower.
The Saudis can't use oil as a weapon. Look, OPEC did it in 1973. They put an embargo. And what happened to the price of oil? It shot up over $100. A few years ago, we saw oil prices tumble. Who created that? It was the Saudis. They flooded the market. Why? They wanted to put shale oil out of business. Well, it backfired.
The partnership between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia rests on linked interests, many of which have either disappeared or are now problematic. The basic bargain of preferred access to energy in return for security protection. But the United States is now the swing producer internationally for oil, given fracking. And we're an energy exporter, not dependent on the Gulf. The support that the Saudis provided by making American foreign policy halal, acceptable to Muslims. Now the Muslim world is so divided, and the United States is so Islamophobic, that that bargain is gone.
Saudi Arabia also controls a vast media empire. For decades, it spent tens of millions of dollars to lobby cultural institutions, think tanks, universities, even governments, all to improve the kingdom's image. That's jumped from $10 million spent in 2016 to more than $27 million today, used to fuel a sophisticated Saudi influence machine. That money shapes policy and perceptions, and it also covers up criticism of the kingdom. Much of this was revealed in 2015 when WikiLeaks published thousands of cable exchanges between Saudi diplomats posted abroad and the foreign ministry. Houston, Texas is an oil town. It's a testament to Saudi soft power and how big Saudi money is securely invested in the U.S. regardless of what Saudi Arabia is accused of. Even a local marathon here is sponsored by Aramco. But whether it's 9/11 or the murder of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, it all continues to cast a shadow over the kingdom's image abroad.
In terms of JASTA, which is the law that was passed basically saying that citizens could sue the Saudi government for the role in 9/11, that has been put forward as a reason not to list on the New York Stock Exchange. I'm not a lawyer, but it would not be a real concern at all. Evidence that at least that's available that the U.S. government has presented and declassified is not significant enough to probably convict or to get a ruling, you know, to be able to sue the Saudi government. So there's that. But say it was. Then the question is, okay, so what kind of assets can you go after? And if you're saying that Aramco is an asset of the Saudi government and therefore should pay, well, there's already a lot of Aramco investment in the United States that they can go after. They can go after Motiva, the largest refinery. They have research centers all over. There's Aramco headquarters, Aramco services company in America. I think that that's a convenient excuse to give, but if they wanted to list on the New York Stock Exchange, it's not really a significant barrier.
Motiva's the largest refinery in the United States, which goes through a whopping 600,000 barrels a day. Its more than 2,000 employees work near the Gulf of Mexico, but this behemoth facility isn't U.S. owned. It's a subsidiary of Aramco, the centerpiece of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's Vision 2030. He wants to expand the petrochemicals business instead of the kingdom's heavy reliance on oil sales. Motiva's so influential in Port Arthur that Motiva security sent a policeman to stop us from filming. They even called the police to hold us until they could question why journalists were filming their facility. Despite tight control over media and any opinion which doesn't fall in line with that of the kingdom, efforts to privatize have been a hard sell at home. With very little accountability of the ruling family, radical changes are viewed with suspicion by many ordinary Saudis.
One of the major objections by people in the kingdom was their fear that the money would go into the pockets of the royal family rather than be used in a transparent way to provide government services to the people. In other words, waste, fraud, and mismanagement are a concern on the part of the public. They're also a concern by foreigners. I think the Crown Prince is trying to create an environment conducive to foreign investment. But things keep happening, questions keep getting raised that make that difficult.
Saudi Arabia's geopolitical power is the exclusive access to information about Saudi reserves. They hold that information very close, and they let it out in dribs and drabs. It's almost like the strategic ambiguity around the Israeli nuclear weapons capability. They release what they choose to release, when they choose to release it. That's a source of power. Very similar with the oil reserves in Saudi Arabia.
This is not the first time reforms have been promised in Saudi Arabia, or the first time when those promises have been lapped up by Western powers and lauded by the media. Since the 1950s, the New York Times, which likes to be called the newspaper of record, has given similar coverage to Saudi kings and princes. The media has given them titles such as trailblazers and reformers, similar to the current crown prince. Even the glitzy 2030 roadmap hints at old promises.
Well, the vision itself is hardly new. This was largely drawn up, I gather, by consultants, McKinsey in particular. And they were able to do that quickly because the Ministry of Planning in Saudi Arabia had all these ideas there to be gathered up. So the vision isn't new. The drive for change in the kingdom, transformative drive, is also not new. In many ways, Mohammed bin Salman resembles his grandfather, Abdulaziz Al Saud. Different methods. Abdulaziz united the kingdom with tribal marriages, a bewildering number of marriages and divorces that brought different groups in the society into his family. He conducted a war in the Saudi south, Najran, Jizan, Asir, which took land from Yemen and made it definitively part of Saudi Arabia. He suppressed religious uprisings. There are many similarities, one could say, and it worked. Whether the current drive will work or not is unknown.
It's certainly not the first time claims of reform have been made in Saudi Arabia. For example, King Faisal, when he became king, he made a lot of very important changes and reforms in Saudi Arabia that before that the government had been spending very recklessly and carelessly under his brother, King Saud. It was reported, actually, that he would carry around in his pocket the budget. And whenever he would see a minister, say, in the halls or something, he would question them. And he would say, how are you spending this money? What are you doing with it? So this is not the first time that reforms have been tried. Probably every previous king in Saudi Arabia has announced it to some extent. And there have been one of the key aspects, I think, that a lot of the reform plans always include are mega projects. And in my mind, those mega projects never really pan out. And so that's always something to be wary of. We can hold up the Aramco IPO as the key example of that, but there were lots of other privatizations that would have really helped kind of remove Saudi Arabia's economy from very status-based to a much more diverse and vibrant private economy. So For example, they wanted to sell parts of Saudi Airlines, of different national companies. And it really almost seems like the reverse is happening, that the state is actually more involved in the economy as opposed to less involved. And that, I think, is probably not a good sign for developing a diverse and vibrant private economy. But at the same time, there are shifts in cultural and social expectations that have to occur in Saudi Arabia. And so those changes, I think setting a year of 2030 is probably very ambitious.
I think the Saudis realize that the time has come, that they must change the way they run the economy, the way they do business. Otherwise, look what happened with Iraq. Look what happened with Iran. Look what happened with Libya. It's not too far-fetched to think that that can't happen with Saudi Arabia.
And utilities has become a burden. It's had to borrow aggressively to plug the budget deficit.
Well, the budgetary crisis is not new. I did have a conversation with the late then Crown Prince Abdullah, later King Abdullah, who made a real effort in the late 90s to institute a tax system other than zakat. And the conversation went like this. I said to him, you know, I think you have a problem here because, for example, in the United States, if I take a section of desert, let's say part of Nevada, and I either invest my own money or I borrow money from a bank and I build an industrial estate, a park, and a related community, and I don't ask the government for anything, the government still has to come up with all sorts of services, police, education, wastewater management, road maintenance, even if I build the roads initially, and so forth. And the same is true in Saudi Arabia, except even more so, because at that time, at least, Saudi Arabia was heavily subsidizing electricity and water and other things that people needed. So I said, you know, the difference is that in Nevada, every cent will come back in the form of increased government revenue. So the debt will be replaced by a stream of revenue that makes the government whole and enables a higher level of service. Whereas in Saudi Arabia, not one halala comes back. Basically, you have a system, I said, in which private prosperity impoverishes the government. It's the opposite of normal economics. So I've said to people, I'll give you a real majlis, a real parliament, and a role in allocating tax resources, but in order to do that, you've got to pay taxes. And he said, I came very close to getting a consensus on this. In the end, I failed. The merchants, particularly in the Western province, would not agree.
So it's difficult to rationalize a big investment in a country that's already a hard sell for investors anyway because of, you know, the visa requirements and red tape and, you know, the lifestyle issues in Saudi Arabia. A lot of foreigners, it's not considered a great destination for second homeowners or for foreigners who are looking to move their families and put their kids in the local schools. They would go to Dubai or Bahrain or Abu Dhabi or Doha to go to the region. So it's, you know, Saudi Arabia's never been a real easy sell for foreign investment for the size of its economy. FDI flows there aren't proportionally as big as they are for some of the more open economies around the region.
Perhaps the biggest challenge to the Saudi economy comes from the wave of change in the way the country is being run. Mohammed bin Salman's pursuit of Vision 2030 has upset the traditional order.
In 2015, when King Salman ascended to the throne, in short order, within a year, all power was essentially transferred into the hands of his favorite son, Mohammed bin Salman. This destroyed the consultative tradition within the royal family and more broadly in the kingdom. Here you had a young man with great ambition, drive, imagination, determined to change things, impatient, and not willing to wait for consultation. So a lot of egos have been bruised. A lot of interests have been shaken. Many people have lodged objections to this fundamental change in the constitutional order in Saudi Arabia. This is before you get to things like the anti-corruption drive, which exacted huge amounts of money from the wealthy elite in the kingdom.
King Salman will be the last king of his generation. It had always passed from brother to brother to brother, and it's clear, even though there are still some living brothers or sons of Abdulaziz, it has been decided that Salman will be the last of that generation. The next generation, there are a lot of princes there, and a lot of them had a great deal of control and in certain segments of the economy and of Saudi society. And there had always been kind of a balancing act that went on between these different segments of the royal family.
There have been a lot of tensions produced. Basically, traditionally in Saudi Arabia and in Gulf Arab societies generally, the king or the emir, the leader, has the same responsibilities as the sheikh in a tribe. There's really two responsibilities. One is to ensure that decisions are taken by consensus after consultation. He proclaims a consensus, does not make a decision and impose it. Second responsibility is to ensure that the less fortunate, the poor, share the wealth. So it's the government, or in this case the leader, must distribute alms, charity, to the needy. The Saudi state is built on these principles. The first one has been badly compromised as power has been gathered into one man's hands, or perhaps two, the crown prince and his father. The members of the family, the ruling family who were previously consulted, feel excluded in many cases from the decision-making process.
They would kind of all meet and had to agree together on things, almost like different shareholders. And it does appear that that process is changing. I would be cautious of saying, well, it's now different. Everything is different now. It's a one-man show. That may be the image that they'd like to present to everyone, but that doesn't mean that all of the other sources of power have necessarily been eliminated, and that if enough brothers decide that Mohammed bin Salman is not the right way, that couldn't be changed. I think it's too early to write off that process and to say that he has fully consolidated power.
$533 million, $525 million, that's peanuts for you.
From lucrative military contracts to support for each other's wars, there is a special relationship between the U.S. president, the Saudi king, and Mohammed bin Salman.
Always the right hand, right? Always the right.
But that special relationship has been under stress lately.
And I love the king, King Salman, but I said, King, we're protecting you. You might not be there for 2 weeks without us. You have to pay for your military.
We filmed this during the period when the Saudi government was officially denying that its agents murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The government later confessed to the killing at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and admitted it was a premeditated murder. A lot of fingers are pointed at the crown prince for allegedly ordering the killing in Turkey, but the U.S. president still has unwavering support for Mohammed bin Salman.
I don't know if anyone's going to be able to conclude that the crown prince did it, but I will say this, I don't know. I don't know. But whether he did or whether he didn't, he denies it vehemently. His father denies it, the king, vehemently.
The case remains open regardless of Saudi denials and criminal sentences. It risks the prince's grip on power, foreign investment, Vision 2030, and Aramco's IPO. Despite several attempts, Aramco and its subsidiaries did not respond to our request for interviews.
Thank you so much.
find their test people.
The killing of the Saudi journalist, that has put them in the spotlight. And if they come forward and tell the whole truth of what happened, then that will be a sign that they're really ready for change. If not, they may be faced with harsh economic sanctions. And if that's the case, the market seems to be saying, well, Saudi Arabia's economy is going to fall off a cliff.
On the foreign policy front, the kingdom has lurched into a series of adventures, none of which have turned out well. It is stuck with a garrison, along with others from the Gulf Cooperation Council, in Bahrain, where unrest continues and shows no sign of abating. It has become really battered by Syria, which has been a transformative situation in the Middle East, brought the Russians back in as the major foreign player, for example. Saudi Arabia's relationships with Turkey have been badly damaged by this. It has seen fit to divide itself from Qatar and conduct blockade, which again shows no sign of going away, and which essentially divides the Gulf Cooperation Council irreparably. And finally, of course, it is engaged in a war in Yemen with no clear objective that is feasible and no war termination strategy.
Saudi Aramco's failure to launch and a young leader's stumble from one crisis to another are direct.
On January 6, QAnon came out of the shadows. What had started as an online conspiracy theory had quickly become a kind of cult. And for some QAnon followers, this was the day they'd been waiting for.
I'm here because you sent me.
They made their presence known in the crowd of Trump supporters in Washington that day. When a mob stormed the Capitol, many QAnon supporters were on the front lines. At least one supporter died that day. This woman, Ashley Babbitt, tried to break through a door inside the Capitol. She was shot to death by a Capitol police officer. She was a 14-year veteran of the Air Force and the Air National Guard. This is her in a QAnon shirt at a Trump rally in September. How does a veteran fall into a deranged conspiracy cult? To understand what QAnon is, you have to go down a rabbit hole where suspicion and fantasy mix with age-old anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and resentments.
We will not cower down to evil!
Some Q believers liken it to a scene in The Matrix, when the truth of the world is revealed to those who take the right pill. The truth, according to Q, was that then-President Trump was a kind of messiah. Some Q followers believed he might actually have been a time traveler or being from another planet. They believed Trump was secretly fighting a holy war against the deep state and a cabal of Democrats and celebrities who were Satan-worshipping pedophiles, molesting children, and harvesting their blood. It sounds ludicrous, but not if you believe in QAnon. And once you believe, you start to see the signs everywhere.
Maybe it's the calm before the storm.
What's the storm?
Could be the calm before the storm.
What storm, Mr. President?
You'll find out.
Those vague words about the storm spoken by then-President Trump at the White House on October 5, 2017 are often cited as the beginning of what we now know as QAnon.
Could be the calm before the storm.
What storm, Mr. President?
You'll find out.
This was at a time when Iran was in the news.
Thank you, everybody.
There was a lot of tension around relations between the United States and Iran, so a lot of focus on that. And the president said something that was cryptic and strange about a coming storm and how this moment was the calm before the storm. And the reporters in the room sort of seized on that with Iran in mind and asked sort of, what storm, Mr. President? What are you talking about? And he was very sort of, you know, you'll see, wait and see.
Q really took off after this remark that President Trump made. They interpreted that as a coded signal that something called the storm was coming. And the storm, in their minds, was this day of reckoning.
And that became one of the foundational bits of lore for Q, which started posting on an image message board a couple weeks later.
On October 28th, someone who later called themselves Q Clearance Patriot wrote on an online forum called 4chan, which was known for anonymous or Anon posts. Q Clearance Patriot claimed to have a high-level security clearance called Q Clearance, which comes from the Department of Energy.
This was not the first Anon that had claimed to be a high-ranking government insider on 4chan, but Q Clearance Patriot said, basically, I am a member of the Trump administration, I have this Q clearance, this high-level intelligence clearance, and I am providing you with secret information about what's really happening behind the scenes in Washington.
Q claimed Hillary Clinton would soon be arrested, and the military and National Guard would be activated to quell mass riots. The posts incorporated other conspiracy theories that had been online for years. Claims that global elites, high-level Democratic leaders, and celebrities were all working to sex traffic children.
They, kidnap and traffic and torture and kill children for fun as part of a satanic ritual, but also in order to harvest a life-extending chemical called adrenochrome from their blood. And that President Trump was recruited by the military in order to bring this cabal down and bring its members to justice. And that he has been secretly working to eliminate the deep state and to find and arrest and punish the members of this global cabal.
Elizabeth Newman served in the Department of Homeland Security when QAnon first emerged and said the claims being made were so preposterous it was hard to take them seriously.
I think most of us just on its face dismissed it because, first of all, a Q clearance has nothing to do with the things that he was talking about. And second of all, having been serving in multiple administrations, holding very high security clearances, working in White House and Department of Homeland Security, none of those conspiracies, whether it's Q or any of those other things, have any merit. They're completely baseless. None of us foresaw this catching fire the way that it did.
The false sex trafficking claims targeting Hillary Clinton actually dated back to 2016. The conspiracy theory that came to be known as Pizzagate.
After the WikiLeaks email hack in 2016, there was a searchable database where people could just look through all of these emails that WikiLeaks had dropped on the internet. Among them, John Podesta, then Hillary Clinton's campaign chair's emails. And among them, you could find references to Comet Ping Pong, this pizza shop. They started this rumor that Comet was secretly a front for child abuse and that, you know, these emails that were sort of like, what sort of pizza should we order? These conspiracy theorists started saying that pizza and cheese and pasta were code words, referring in fact to child sex abuse. Of course, there's no evidence of that.
Pizzagate's a conspiracy theory.
Mm.
You don't believe it's a conspiracy theory?
No, it's definitely not. Pizza is a code word for child pornography. Cheese pizza, child pornography.
Let's go for anything in this world.
Believing those false claims, a man named Edgar Welch showed up at Comet Ping Pong armed with an AR-15. He claimed he'd come to rescue children he believed were locked in the basement as part of a sex trafficking ring.
It ended up being handled where the police were able to subdue the suspect. He did have weapons on him. It could have turned violent. But the irony of that whole story was that pizza parlor didn't even have a basement.
This, to me, is emblematic just of how much real-world danger this conspiracy theory could cause. But at that moment, people started backing away from Pizzagate, which sort of set the stage for a new conspiracy theory to take its place and borrow heavily from its story. And that's where we get Q.
Some of Q's conspiracy claims go much farther back than Pizzagate. They're actually based on age-old racist and anti-Semitic beliefs. The idea of elites harvesting the blood of children was a notion the Nazis pushed,
They accuse Jews of doing the same thing.
There are elements of this narrative that you can find in, like, Crusades-era conspiracy theorizing. Even during the Black Death in Europe centuries ago, you know, you had conspiracy theories then that said that the Jews were spiking the water with poisonous frogs and lizards. And you get a same sense of that anti-Semitism very much within Q. And so in some ways, this is a very modern conspiracy theory because it is enabled by the social web. In other ways, it goes to some of the most ancient and dark biases and bigotry in human history.
Over the months and years, Q continued posting vague clues, often in the form of questions and riddles. They became known as Q drops. Followers would then spend days and weeks trying to decipher the meaning of them. Certain catchphrases became commonly used among believers.
Where we go one, we go all.
There's sort of a rallying cry that is, where we go one, we go all, which is an expression of solidarity.
They call each other patriots almost universally.
There's this reference to the calm before the storm, this idea that the storm is this moment when a mass number of arrests will take place.
And everything is sort of in this, like, military-esque code.
Thank you very much.
So, you know, POTUS is always used instead of calling him President Trump. Or Hillary Clinton in the QAnon drops is never Hillary Clinton, she's always HRC.
There's the Great Awakening, which refers to this period after the storm when Q believers believe there'll be sort of a society-wide spiritual awakening.
There are also things like, enjoy the show would be sort of like watch for fireworks in the coming days.
Similarly is trust the plan.
Trusting the plan is an important part of QAnon belief because there are sometimes that the predictions don't pan out and the things that Q has said would happen don't.
It's not clear if anything Q had predicted has come true. The first post said that Hillary Clinton was about to be arrested. Q also predicted other dates when this non-existent global cabal would be exposed. There were supposed to be mass arrests of deep state actors and martial law, all fantasy. But it didn't seem to matter to Q followers. They either ignored the inconsistencies or explained them away.
Q had made reference to D5, and that had been interpreted as a sign that something big was going to happen on December 5th. Some report was going to be unveiled that unmasked the deep state conspiracy, and then that turned out to be the day of George H.W. Bush's funeral. And so QAnon believers convinced themselves that D5 was a reference to the fact that on December 5th, at this funeral, when all these world leaders, including former presidents and you know, people who are allegedly part of this cabal would be in attendance in the same building, that was going to be when the mass arrests happened. And obviously that didn't happen. There were no mass arrests. And so instead of admitting, like, you know, we were wrong, maybe this D5 thing didn't happen, they sort of reimagined the claim. They said maybe it's December 7th, actually. So therefore, the real date is sometime in the future. And that's constantly happening with QAnon.
So this has been one of the more mind-melting aspects of reporting on Q for me, that you talk to people who are true believers.
We are Q.
And you can confront them with reality, you know, evidence of here is what happened. We both saw this with our own eyes. Why do you still believe? And there's just an utter rejection of reality and a total faith in Q with no sort of attention to empiricism or regard for the facts.
Siddharth Jadeja says he was a true believer in QAnon until about a year and a half ago. He explains the passion many Q followers still have.
This is, to them, they believe this. And they don't, this is not like a battle between, you know, Marxists and capitalists, between authoritarians and libertarians, between nation.